wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO here in Portland, where the time is 9:02, and time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. The mole is the beast that works underground, burrowing to expose and undermine the foundations of a society based on rewarding the few for the labor of the many, and that steals from the poor what it gives to the rich. I'm Clayton Morgridge, your host for today's show. Our engineer is Patricia Kullberg. On today's show, we'll be discussing the Green New Deal, the proposal to repurpose the American economy, to radically reduce and eventually to eliminate our dependence on fossil fuels, and in the process, to provide meaningful and well-paid labor to everyone who wants to work. Bill Resnick and Marty Hart Landsberg will be discussing what the Green New Deal can learn from the original New Deal of the 1930s and early 40s, which was designed to provide jobs during the Great Depression. As we will see, it required mass public action to make the New Deal happen, and the same will be required of us to get government to act today. The original New Deal supported not only the building and repair of roads and bridges and post offices, but it supported art and artists as well. The arts and craftspeople of the Paris Commune of 1871 also understood that the creative arts needed to be front and center in the new social order they were trying to build. I'll have a commentary about why our Green New Deal likewise must build a beautiful environment for us and for future generations. In the second half of today's Old Mole, our movie moles Denise Morris and Victoria Saucedo will be reviewing the controversial new film Joker. And Joe Clement will present a song by Leon Rosselson, "Who Reaps the Profits, Who Pays the Price?" It's a working-class indictment of the capitalist imperative to turn everything, our lives and the earth, into money. It's a beautiful and powerful call to overthrow that system. If you like what you hear on our show, you can listen to it again or to any of the segments by finding us on the KBOO website. That's kboo.fm/oldmole. And you can subscribe to our podcast through iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's show will be available later today or tomorrow. So now to start off today's show, here's Bill Resnick to talk with Marty Hart Landsberg about the Green New Deal and the lessons of Roosevelt's New Deal that got underway in the 1930s and gained steam after World War II. Now, this is the first part of a two-part interview. Part two will be on next week's show. Here's Bill.
Hi, Marty Hart Landsberg. Welcome to KBOO.
Thanks, Bill. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Martin Hart Landsberg is a teacher, writer, activist. He directed the political economy program at Lewis and Clark College for more than 20 of his 38 years that he spent teaching there. He's written a slew of books, including Capitalist Globalization, Consequences, Resistance, and Alternatives. He does alternatives in all of his books. He's also written on China and socialism, market reforms, and class struggles, the title of that book. He's very active in Portland. He served on the executive board of Jobs with Justice. He's on the workers' rights board of Jobs with Justice. And he's a leader of the organization Portland Rising. Finally, his blog on the economic front is a treasure of economic thought that's won thousands of regular readers, most not economists. Recently, he wrote, it's on his blog, a short and accessible, very accessible essay. It's in four parts, still short, titled an essay, What the New Deal Can Teach About Winning a Green New Deal. So, Marty, tell us why you wrote on the lessons of the New Deal. It's known as the 30s New Deal and the Great Depression, but in fact, the New Deal lasted for quite a long time and became more important, actually, in the 50s and 60s.
Well, I think what really led me back to that period was first just being taken by the enormous excitement that the notion of a Green New Deal has generated. And I think, you know, the excitement of that was really giving people a sense of a new way to live, a whole new way to imagine relationships, social, economic, environmental. And I think it really stimulated a lot of people in important political ways.
It's a whole reconstruction, not just of the economy.
Yeah. And I think that one of the ways in which the Green New Deal has rooted in people's minds and has added to its popularity is the fact that it says New Deal in it. And people have a vision of the 30s as a period when we suffered a major crisis, a period when we really needed an enormous transformation of our economy. And the government stepped in and, as it's kind of popularly understood, implemented these transformative policies which solved our crisis and moved us ahead into a new economy that served our needs far better.
And made Roosevelt a beloved national leader for having dealt with the Great Depression and saved us so many children from starvation, with 30% unemployment in the country, with huge numbers of evictions, people on the road.
Oh, definitely. And so, yeah. So if you have this period in mind where there was this need for transformative change and government policy comes in and does it, it makes it easier to imagine a Green New Deal where we face another need for another transformative set of policies, and we need a government to lead us. And so this is what's become very important.
And like back then, it calls for a fundamental reconstruction that people actually want.
Yes.
And so we have this idea of the New Deal.
Right.
It
gives us a feeling that these things can be done.
Right.
So for me, it is a little bit far afield, but it's sort of how I think about it. When people in the labor movement got very excited by the teacher strikes, and particularly, say, West Virginia strike, which was a statewide teacher strike, not only for higher teacher salary, but for all education workers, taxes. Knowing about that inspired people in other places. And inspiration is one thing. But the question is, how did they do that strike? How did they organize statewide? How did they create leaders in local schools? How did they connect them? How did they decide? That's what becomes very important. And for me, the same thing was true about the New Deal in the Green New Deal. Yes, it was inspiring, but there's things that we need to be learning about the actual experience of the New Deal that can alert us to the kinds of challenges and struggles we're going to face if we're going to get a Green New Deal.
Yeah, let's get into that more deeply. How the New Deal developed and the resistance, the tremendous resistance of capital to do. I'll give a little bit of a summary. Yeah. There is always tremendous resistance from capital, from the business owners. They saw people starving and they thought, oh, it's a local challenge. Let the churches take care of it. That was their response. We're not going to do anything because this lasted for quite a while. In fact, the Great Depression was going on over 10 years until World War II, and the economy was in bad shape. But people were organizing. That's the point.
Well, yes. And so then, I mean, just to build on what you're saying, the Great Depression went on for 4 years before the movement, which I'll get to in a second, was able to push Roosevelt to some very minor reforms, which are considered in 1933 his first New Deal. And what's so sobering about that, and why it's important for the movement for a Green New Deal to understand these things, is that in those first 4 years of depression, it was also a time of hard times for capitalists. And even despite that, they were unwilling to endorse policies that would upset the status quo. They remained committed to no federal relief programs, no deficit spending, nothing that would upset kind of the free market that they have. And in this case, where we're talking about a crisis, it's not even at this point a crisis of profitability for capital. So what we really need to be aware of is that we can't expect those with power in this system, this is sort of the first lesson, to say, oh my, I recognize the crisis, let's do something.
Yeah, in fact, the first New Deal, I read your four sections, I'm looking forward to the fifth.
And last.
The first New Deal, after 4 years of Roosevelt in power, spent the actions he took were basically to support business. There was very little support, public relief, for ordinary people where there was enormous starvation and people on the rails.
Yeah. And I think this is another lesson to learn from in organizing around a Green New Deal, what we can learn from the original deal, which was that it took, and I want to be a little more specific about the organizing because there are some important lessons there, but it took enormous organizing to force in the first New Deal very limited relief programs. People were asking for federally organized relief, money, welfare for people who are unemployed. Roosevelt refused to do it. He set up a system where he would make, the federal government would make loans to the states if the states put in some money of their own for relief payments. And most of the states were broke, so very few of them took it up. The people who are unemployed were demanding a jobs program. And Roosevelt was very specific. He said, we're not going to get into the business of employing people, but he agreed for a four-month period, a very temporary period of work, which when he saw was going to be expensive because of the millions of people who needed jobs, he canceled. So one of the first lessons is that that first New Deal, which was a response to workers' demands, really didn't meet people's needs. And if the movement had just sort of stopped then, who knows how long people would have suffered. But they continued to build. And let me go back then to what did it take to even get that, and why were they able to build movements that were able to respond to minimal government policies by pushing them further? And here I think is really important is that the organizing that took place early on was in many ways thanks to the Communist Party, which organized councils of unemployed. And they had begun doing that in 1929, even before the start of the Great Depression. And what those were sort of block groups of people who were unemployed who would come together to fight for relief at relief offices and to restrict evictions. And what they would do, in some cities there might be 60, 70 unemployed councils who would form together to also form a state unemployed council. And so what began to happen is that workers would go in mass to relief offices if a relief office had turned down someone's application and say, we're not leaving, or we threaten to burn down this building until you give relief to such and such a family. Or if the courts tried to evict, ordered sheriffs to evict someone, they would go in mass and stop those evictions.
And put the furniture back in the house.
Yep. And what began to happen is that people who felt alone, responsible for their own problems, began to see problems as structural in nature. And what began to happen is as cities and states felt overwhelmed by people suddenly saying, we're not going to accept the laws or the institutions as valid given what's happening, they began to put pressure on the federal government. So in a sense, the movement was able to kind of press local levels of power up on national powers. At the same time, because the party was a national organization and the councils of unemployed were national, they were organizing national movements for a national unemployment system, for a national job creation system, for a national relief system. And what they would do is not just fly delegates to Washington, D.C., but they would do caravans where they would speak in different cities about the need for programs, which built the unemployed councils and then built a movement in support of those programs. And even on the very first day of Roosevelt's inauguration, they were there with national demonstrations for an unemployed system.
So this was in 1936.
This was in 1933 on his first inauguration.
Really?
Yep.
Wow.
So what was happening is that the Roosevelt administration, which in its early days actually was cutting spending, was seeing that governors and state officials were saying, we're on the verge of revolution in our cities. Our police are being disregarded. Our courts are being disregarded. Our welfare office, we don't have resources. You need to do something. And it was that kind of public pressure that led to the first New Deal, which, as you said, Bill, was initially largely supporting business with some very modest and unacceptable minimal offers to relief and unemployment.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Martin Art Landsberg, who has written a lot of books and directed the political economy program at Lewis and Clark College for a long time, has lots of wonderful students who are now writing. I'm sure you're proud of that, Marty. he wrote recently a piece that he published on his blog, and it's a enormous treasury of economic thought. The most recent piece is the What the New Deal Can Teach Us About Winning a Green New Deal. So, Marty, we talked about the very hesitant approach of the Roosevelt machine, even after they were elected by the people to do something and promised to do something, but they didn't want to do something, and the Congress was absolutely unwilling to do something, and the capitalists thought, things will get better. We're still making money or whatever.
Right.
At least we are. We've laid off a lot of workers. And really nothing was done in the first. Certainly no public relief. Very, very little public relief. Maybe reached 2% of the people.
Yeah. I think about two-thirds of the people without jobs were not eligible for relief. State relief was even very minimal. Often it was just scripts for basic food, nothing for housing or other necessities.
And those are the people with jobs, actually. But, of course, they were sometimes working 10 hours a week because these companies were failing.
So one of the questions, one of the things that becomes interesting when you're building a movement, they're choices. And there were other groups of unemployed who said, let's do self-help work and let's not organize resistance. And there were other groups who said, well, let's try and lobby the legislature, but let's not do direct organizing. And I think what was so powerful about that movement and an important lesson for those trying to organize and think about a Green New Deal is that the kind of organizing that went on provided a means for people to come together in self-defense locally to transform how they understood the causes of the problem and created a context for them to be connected as part of a national movement where they could see that national policies could help them, but that what they were doing was also contributing to building weight for a national change. It wasn't just only local, it wasn't only national, but it was a kind of a transformative organizing. And what it did is also produce a lot of people with the capacity to be incredible organizers. And that becomes a key in some ways to how the movement was able to respond to Roosevelt's minimal offerings in his first New Deal. Because the success of that unemployed organizing spread to other groups. So you began to get the Socialist Party, you began to get groups that were organized that were followers of A.J. Mustey, who was a minister, pacifist, labor activist, who spread around, and they were now making this movement nationally. But what happened then is when Roosevelt's minimal effort at reform, at relief, created more people on relief, the left group started organizing workers, people on relief, saying, we want more relief. We want less intrusive financial inspections. We want higher pay.
You mean the workers and the recipients.
The recipients and the workers on relief programs joined together in what was called relief leagues. And they were beginning to say, look, this is unacceptable. We need a better system. And as the economy began to recover from 25% unemployment down to, say, 15% unemployment by 1934, labor movements began to grow. And who were some of the leading activists were people who came out of the unemployed organizing, who had experience and who understood what it meant. And they began to power a labor resurgence, which are highlighted by enormous auto strike in Toledo, Ohio, enormous trucking strike led by a Trotskyist local of the Teamsters in 34, and what turned out to be a general strike in San Francisco as part of the longshore. And so what happened then, and at the same time, movements were growing, demanding a real Social Security Act. And so what happened is Roosevelt, who thought that his first New Deal might satisfy, was now being faced with not only continued unemployed organizing demanding relief and jobs, relief workers organizing demanding improvement in relief, and a labor movement that was now demanding unions and, in fact, all of those movements.
Wages, jobs, shorter hours, minimum wage, unemployment insurance.
Yeah, and also showing that when you launch a general strike, you're saying, the rules are no longer going to be the rules. That it's essentially saying workers are going to be establishing and determining what power looks like. And the same with unemployed organizing and relief organizing who are engaging in strikes, disregarding laws, challenging the police and the courts. And it was this kind of pressure that led Roosevelt, with his advisor saying to him, something has to be done in 35 to launch what was called the Second New Deal.
Or we're going to have a revolution in this country.
This is the danger.
Yes.
So the question is then, from a Green New Deal point of view, how do you prepare people right now to understand how real significant change unfolds?
Yes, she got them for sale. Hotter than the red, huh? Yes, she got them for sale. I got a good such a long and tall. She sleeps in the kitchen with a piece in the hall. Hotter than the red, huh? Yes, she got them for sale, I mean. Yes, she got them for sale, yeah. Hotter than the red, huh? Yes, she got them for sale. Hotter than the red, huh? Yes, she got them for sale. She got 2 foot nickel, got 4 foot dime. Say more, but there ain't none of mine. Hot tamale than the red hot. Yes, she got them for sale, I mean.
And that's Robert Johnson's there, Red Hot, about selling hot tamales in 1935, 2 for a nickel, 4 for a dime. Following up on part one of Bill Resnick's two-part interview with Marty Hart Lansbury, next Monday we will hear about how World War II ended the Great Depression and how working-class movements maintained themselves and kept fighting. Workers finally forced capital and its government to create the set of New Deal programs, including Social Security and unemployment insurance. But these programs have eroded over the past 40 years as business became more powerful. Marty and Bill will also examine how the Green New Deal can, not instantly but perhaps quickly enough, reconstruct this country to stop cataclysmic climate change. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO. I'm Clayton Morgridge. And right now, I'd like to turn to another lesson we should learn from the original New Deal and demand from a Green New Deal. And that is massive support for artists and the works of artists and craftspeople. Now, one of the best places to learn about how an artistic sensibility guided New Deal projects is at Timberline Lodge here in Oregon on Mount Hood, where you can see how architecture, mural painting, weaving, furniture making, and carving were integrated into a public building. But there are thousands and thousands of similar projects that were undertaken all across the country, where it was not just builders and engineers who planned and executed the work, but artists as well. As Wikipedia tells us, the Federal Art Project was a New Deal program to fund the visual arts in the United States. It was one of 5 projects sponsored by the Works Progress Administration, or WPA, and the largest of the New Deal art projects. It was created not as a cultural activity, but as a relief measure to employ artists and artisans to create murals, easel paintings, sculpture, graphic art, posters, photography, theater design, and arts and crafts. The WPA Federal Art Project established more than 100 community art centers throughout the country, researched and documented American design, commissioned a significant body of public art without restriction to content or subject matter, and sustained some 10,000 artists and craft workers during the Great Depression. End of quote. Well, the New Deal Art Project was put together by the federal government mainly in order to give work to unemployed artists. But there's another historical precedent which is not only more democratic, but which arose from an appreciation of the importance of art, not just the so-called fine arts, but every manner of creation that aims to be beautiful as well as useful. This precedent is the Paris Commune of 1871. As Kristen Ross describes the context of this in her book, Communal Luxury, The Political Imaginary of the Paris Commune, for 72 days in the spring of 1871, a worker-led insurrection transformed the city of Paris into an autonomous commune and set about improvising the free organization of its social life, according to principles of association and cooperation. Ordinary people in a major European capital were exercising powers and capacities normally reserved for a ruling elite, until the commune was savagely put down by the state. But let's look at what the commune accomplished in the realm of art as a lesson for our Green New Deal. And I'll be quoting off and on from Kristen Ross's book. The first thing that was done was to make artists and artistic production independent of the state, and of course of the patronage of wealthy elites. At a meeting of artists, the demand was made that artists be allowed to administer the arts themselves, that they assume control of museums and art collections. Artists should be entrusted to manage their own interests. Some 400 artists attended the meeting, and they were not just painters and sculptors, but a rallying of all the different kinds of artistic intelligence together thought of as one. Architects, cabinet makers, and even shoemakers were thought of as artists, producers whose works were to be valued not merely for their utility, but for their beauty, for the pleasure they gave to the senses. Painters and sculptors were not to be making objects to be privately owned in the homes of the wealthy or placed in museums and galleries away from ordinary people. The demand that beauty flourish in spaces shared in common and not just in special privatized preserves means reconfiguring art to be fully integrated into everyday life and not just sequestered in special places called museums. Art would no longer live this poor, thin life among a few exceptional men, as one communard put it. Some of the exhilaration of the project of making art lived, not superfluous or trivial, but vital and indispensable to the community, is captured in this short text from the time called Art and the People. Ah, if the painters and sculptors were free, there would be no need for them to shut themselves up in salons. They would have but to reconstruct our cities, first demolishing those ignoble cubes of stone where human beings are piled up, rich and poor, the beggar and the pompous millionaire, starvelings and satiated victims and hangmen. They would burn all the old barracks of the time of misery in an immense fire of joy. The liberation of art means eliminating the separation between what is useful and what is beautiful. It means treating beauty as an essential element of what makes something useful, whether it be a house, a piece of furniture, an office, or even a factory. What makes beauty so important that we should design society in a way that encourages the creation of beauty in everything we make? It is simply that beauty is part of what makes life good, not just living in beautiful surroundings, but also the ability to create what is beautiful. Many of the places we go to and go through are banal and dull. Think of most of Southeast 82nd Avenue here in Portland, or insides of many office buildings, or downright ugly things like slums, battlefields, jails and prisons, slaughterhouses, multi-lane highways, the interiors of the homes of many very poor people who lack the time, resources, and often the heart to envision and create beauty in their lives. A world bereft of beauty is depressing and breeds resentment. As Marx points out, unlike other animals, human beings make things even when they have no immediate need for them, and indeed they truly produce only in freedom from such need. Human beings produce in accordance with the laws of beauty, says Marx. But capital is not human. From its point of view, the point of view of the investor, there is little or nothing to be gained by making beauty part of the world they build, aside from their corporate offices and private homes. Beauty is an invitation to love. A beautiful world is one we can love. In promoting a Green New Deal, we need to be inviting people to join in creating a beautiful world they can love, not just one capable of surviving the rigors of climate change. We say a better world is possible, but it will be possible only if people love the vision of that possible world. So the world the Green New Deal proposes has to be beautiful. I'm Clayton Borgridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
I wish I could give all I'm longing to give. I wish I could live like I'm longing to live. I wish I could do all the things that I can do, though I'm way overdue. I'd be stuck.
That's Nina Simone wishing she could be free to do all the things that she can do, following my commentary on the need to include the arts, which would certainly include music, in the Green New Deal. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour here on KBOO. Next up, the Old Mole's Joe Clement introduces a song about basic Old Mole themes, the exploitation of our lives and the plundering of the earth by capital and the blind pursuit of profits. Stay tuned after the song for the Movie Mole's review of Joker. Here's Joe.
This is Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Up next, we're going to listen to a long didactic song by Leon Rosselson. Leon Rosselson is a prolific British singer-songwriter. He has written absolutely poetic and stirring songs that he often sings while playing guitar. His songs have a decidedly socialist kind of messaging to it, from his Song of the Old Communist to Billy Bragg's cover of The World Turned Upside Down, which is about the Christian communist movement in the 17th century to overthrow the enclosure of the commons. Rosselson's songs tap into a lost sense of indigeneity that Americans have long since given up since coming to the New World, but that was under attack in medieval Europe as commercial and colonial powers were starting to take root, notably in Britain. But as his song, Stand Up for Judas, makes clear, the civilizational project that has wiped out indigenous people across the world has, in Europe, certain roots that go all the way back to the Roman Empire. Maybe it's true what Philip K. Dick said, the empire never ended. Part of what makes this next song interesting and why I want to share it in its entirety is because it goes through this dialectical, dual perspective of oppressor and oppressed. The oppressor is the one who is handing down orders, but they are also kind of divorced from their life. Others are taking care of all the menial tasks because the most important and weightier matters are saved for them. There's a recurring theme of the commodification of everything. One crop is as good as another as long as the catch keeps pouring in. And there's subtle snark leveled against the idea that they represent progress and the future, and that that future is a good one. Along the way, we hear critical verses about moral relativism and handing out checks to charity so no one can call you mean. And then there's the recurring perspective of the oppressed, who are identified as black like the dust, brown like the earth. We hear the story of their enslavement and of being worked to death in mines. We hear themes of colonization as people's tongues and stories are taken away from them. But also an energizing kind of, well, not nostalgia, because I believe in it, and I don't think you can believe in nostalgia, but a memory of the old ways. And in a verse very close to the end of the song, there's this transcendental feeling invoked when they sing, "Someday and soon, the mountains will shake, the drum will sound, the sun will turn black, and from the dust and from under the earth, we will arise proclaiming this truth. All life is sacred, all life is one, from the rocks on the mountain to the children to come." We're being brought to the concept of caring for the future generation, 7 generations down the line, it's sometimes recommended. Without further ado, Leon Rosselson sings, "Who reaps the profit? Who pays the price?"
You sit there handing down orders. You examine the terms of the deal. A car is always waiting. Other hands turn the wheel. The doors slide open before you. The door slides shut behind. Other hands carry your luggage. Weightier matters engage your mind. You take the gold out of the earth. You throw the corpses in. One crop is as good as another, as long as the cash keeps pouring in.
The wheels must never stop turning. The machine must be obeyed. The future has got to be fueled, and there's a price to be paid.
Black like the dust, brown like the earth, this is our land, the land of our birth. Silently digging, digging our graves, choking our bodies, choking our lives.
Living on scraps, dying in debt, digging in darkness so our children can eat. Once we were free, greeting the sun, sharing the earth, giving thanks to the corn. Sang with the waters, sang with the wind, danced with the drum, circled without end.
Now we are silent, they have taken our tongues, they have taken our pride, they have taken our songs. Only our bodies, only our eyes, burn with the memory of the old ways.
Brown like the earth, black like the dust, who can we turn to, who can we trust?
You've got no patience with failure, you've got no time for delay. Certainty points to the future, straight lines carve out the way. You never make moral judgments, only one truth you defend. Money must be free to make money, that's all there is in the end. You take the diamonds out of the earth, you throw the corpses in. One crop is as good as another, as long as the cash keeps pouring in.
The wheels must never stop turning, the machine must be obeyed. The future has got to be fueled, and there's a price to be paid.
Brown like the earth, black like the dust, who can we turn to, who can we trust? The gun is their god, they have taken our land. They take what we dig, they take without end.
We drown in the dust, we choke in the heat. Our skin grows sores, our lungs rot.
Still we remember the cold clear air, waking at dawn with a morning star. Still we remember the sound of the flute, the feel of the grass under our feet.
Death may come quickly, if the mine floods, if the rock talks, if the gas explodes.
Mostly we linger on death's cold bed, clutching for air, coughing up blood.
Nobody cares, nobody sees. We make no headlines, dying by degrees.
A thousand shapes wait to attend you, the ones who drive your cars, who reserve your place at the table, who order your daily cigars, who
silently guard your privacy,
who make sure your ties are new,
who remind you of your appointments. You know that they all depend on you. You take the uranium out of the earth, you throw the corpses in. One crop is as good as another, as long as the cash keeps pouring in. The wheels must never stop turning, the machine must be obeyed. The future has got to be fueled, and there's a price to be paid.
Nobody cares, nobody sees. We make no headlines, dying by degrees. What choice do we have? They have taken our home. We wait in silence, our time will come.
They tear from the earth, they leave nothing behind. Only raw scars on a wasteland.
Someday and soon, the mountains will shake, the drum will sound. The sun will turn black, and from out of the dust, and from under the earth, we will arise, proclaiming this truth. All life is sacred, all life is one, from the rocks on the mountains to the children unborn. And the walls will topple,
and the fences will fall, and the scars will be healed, and the earth will be whole.
This is our land, the land of our birth, black like the dust, brown like the earth.
You never carry money, you like your life ordered and clean. You make out checks to charity, no one can call you mean. Through your double-locked gateways, only the privileged pass. Admire your taste and elegance, marvels of marble and silver and glass. You take the earth out of the earth, you throw the corpses in. One crop is as good as another, as long as the cash keeps pouring in. The wheels must never stop turning, the machine must be obeyed. The future has got to be fueled, and there's a price to be paid.
And that's Leon Russellson with his song, Who Reaps the Profits, Who Pays the Price, here on the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO. And now, as promised, the Movie Mole's Denise Morris and Victoria Saucedo to review Joker.
It's 1981 in Gotham City. Arthur Fleck lives with his mother, Penny, in a shabby apartment, works as a party clown, and aspires to be a stand-up comedian, writing jokes while chain-smoking in his free time. Gotham is in the thick of decay. High unemployment, a lengthy garbage strike, social services are being cut, and billionaire Thomas Wayne is running for mayor, vowing to clean up the trash, literally and figuratively. Wayne promising Gotham will be great again. Joker, directed by Todd Phillips and co-written with Scott Silver, took inspiration from the 1988 graphic novel Batman, The Killing Joke. But this film is far from the DC comic film translations of the past. Director Phillips envisioned this Joker origin story as a, quote, way to sneak a real movie in the studio system under the guise of a comic book film. Phillips looked to films like Taxi Driver and King of Comedy, among others, to create a visual style and feel that matched the film's fictional time period. Joker, starring Joaquin Phoenix, Francis Conroy, Zazie Beetz, and Robert De Niro, has been the center of much controversy, including what some have described as a moral panic resulting in fears that the film will launch an anarchist revolt in the streets, or forever dash our hopes for a socialist revolution. So is this film the most powerful film ever? A superhero itself? Is it a character study, not just of Arthur Fleck, who becomes Joker, but of the nature of American austerity and the ravages it leaves in its wake? Victoria Saucedo, welcome back to KBOO.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. I'm glad to have you because I need you for this one. You are, Victoria, more schooled in the world of DC Comics and Marvel films. Oh, you would say immersed.
Although I would say maybe immersed in the pop culture of the movies.
Very immersed?
Pretty immersed. Capable of watching them over and over.
Oh, yeah. More capable than I. But it's great to have you. We saw this film. We saw it once.
I would say, though, that this movie is definitely a movie that begs repeated viewings.
And, you know, essentially, we could say the film comes with baggage. Neither of us saw or read anything about the film.
Correct. We both went into it trying to go in again with what I call that pure experience, not having read reviews, just go in and see the movie.
Mm-hmm. Joker leaves behind the fantastical kind of superhero stuff, along with all the fast action, the special effect. It's a much different look at an origin story.
It really is. And so in the world of comic book movies, it is very grounded in reality. There's no one with a superpower. And unless you think about the Wayne family, their superpower is wealth, extreme wealth. But this movie is different. Because it's so grounded in reality, I think that is actually the nature of the controversy of the film. There's no one that defies gravity. You can't go to an alternate universe. There's no upside down. This is real. Mm-hmm. Social services are cut. Someone loses their job. People are murdered. And it's set in this alternate reality, so to speak. Gotham, 1981. But the movie is really talking about the decay of the system, the social services, the failure of the commons that just go away, and what results? Death, despair, destruction. It's this destruction not only of the family, but of the human body.
Isolation. And this is a big part of who Arthur Fleck is. He lives with his mother, who I think is a very interesting character, has a job.
Precarious as it is, he does have a job, something that he's supposed to go to ostensibly day in and day out. So again, that grounds him in his community. The relationship with his mother grounds him. And slowly but surely, he loses everything that keeps him a functioning member of society.
A lot of people have had criticisms about the characterization of mental health in the film. And then there's way more to say about that, neither of us being experts in that area.
You know, for Arthur, the show begins. He's mugged on the street by what he terms just a bunch of kids. He goes home kind of broken, bruised up, defeated. He takes care of a parent. We see him visiting his social worker. We see him subsequently losing his job. So for me, it's a very honest picture of the precarious, frankly, medical services that anyone has on the margin. His job doesn't come with those social services. He gets those social services because he's too poor to afford actual mental health care on his own, private, that kind of thing. So I take the stance that this movie is an indictment of the system, the failure of the system.
Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, it's an origin story about a decades-old arch-villain.
Correct. Super arch-villain, absolutely.
Super arch-villain.
Batman's primary nemesis.
That's right. And you have said basically the Wayne family and by extension Batman. Batman's superpower is wealth.
Correct. That's his penultimate shield, Bruce Wayne's defiance. His extreme wealth will always, always protect him.
Mm-hmm.
And it's wielded like a bludgeon over everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
Including somebody who's that marginalized. Yes, we can discuss, you know, Arthur Fleck being a straight white man in America. He is not powerful in this movie.
The only condition that we understand about Arthur is that he laughs at inappropriate moments.
Correct, and it's supposed to be this Tourette's-like reaction to stress. So in a stressful situation, he will laugh uncontrollably. And it does sound weirdly maniacal because he cannot stop it. And you do see him trying to stop himself. He wraps his hands around his throat, trying to choke off what he knows is inappropriate laughter.
Mm-hmm. And what's the worst thing in a social circumstance is to laugh inappropriately?
Yeah.
I mean, this is part of the thing that's so interesting to me about this film is the way that it really digs into these questions about how people fit in and in what circumstances. His mother, Penny, he refers to her telling him, you know, you should smile. You're put here to make people smile. We both have agreed that the mother character is actually an underappreciated character in the film and tells us a lot about some of the dynamics that happen with working class people or people who are struggling in poverty and their relationship to wealth and the kind of fantasies that evolve around those attachments. Could I become that? Could I be helped by that? Do they actually care about me? So in the film, Arthur is really her primary caretaker as well as her friend, her husband, her son. I mean, he is everything to her.
And subsequently, she is actually that for him. That is his primary social outlet.
And they watch TV, and in an interesting ode to King of Comedy with Robert De Niro, who was obsessed with becoming a comedian and was obsessed with Jerry Lewis in that film, Robert De Niro finds himself in Joker as the late-night TV host. And Penny and Arthur watch his show religiously every night. Arthur's relationship to Murray Franklin is a lifeline.
Absolutely. It's one of the few things that he has, this delusional life where he's on the show making jokes, is kind of the successful comic, that he could go on the show and say hi to everybody, wave to the audience and get a hug from the host and sit down and talk.
You know, I push back on some of the criticisms of that in terms of how it depicts him in mental health. We all live delusional relationships. I mean, isn't it a delusional relationship that working class people have any connection or interest or hold any billionaires in high esteem, and yet we've got one running the country right now?
Absolutely. Collected. About a mass delusion.
Right, it's a mass delusion. And so we are accepting circumstances and consenting to exist in a world that is to our detriment.
That is incredibly dire, that is slowly but surely killing all of us.
In the film, the mother has a belief that the powers that be will help not just the city as a mayor, as Thomas Wayne, the billionaire, becomes mayor of Gotham City, but that that person would actually care about them and help them as individuals, as an individual struggling family. This, to me, is one of the most interesting parts of the film, is how our ideological and fantasy lives merge with the realities that we actually live in and how we make sense of our existence. One of the criticisms that has come up is this question about whether or not this is a progressive masterpiece, because there's always all sorts of hyperbole that goes on about how it's going to be the greatest thing ever. It's a masterpiece, it's a cinematic, la la la. Because it doesn't show a kind of system correction or a vision of what it would look like on the other side of capitalism, the critique is that it can't possibly be a progressive film.
I think ultimately the film functions at its best when viewed through the lens of not subtle indictment of the system. It's an indictment of capitalism from beginning to end, an indictment of the austerity from beginning to end that is all happening all over the world that we see. It's destroying people's livelihood. It's taking people's homes. It's leaving people with little to no food. Some people don't even have good drinking water. Even in America, you know, Flint still has bad water. I think that the movie really does function on that level the best when you look at it as, again, an indictment of capitalism and how the commons have failed.
There's something about the way that the relationships are developed in the film, about the way the film flows, about the focus on Arthur, interactions at work. It's rich with that kind of thing. And in every detail, in every scene, there is a story being told. And I think that's part of what we struggle with as viewers. As Joaquin Phoenix said, if you don't know the difference between right or wrong, I mean, how can a filmmaker help you figure that out? You know, we're still talking about developing arch villains in DC comic world in the context of Taxi Driver.
Sure, and I do agree. The movie is slowly but surely building that case study, that story, where we see Arthur lose gradually everything. And there's a major break that happens with regard to his childhood, and the person that we know, Arthur, is ultimately gone. All the points at which he could have been helped, all the points at which he could have been stopped, they're gone. They're long gone. And it's useless at this stage of the game.
I wonder if, really, when it's stripped down, it's a cautionary tale about barbarism and about our descent into barbarism.
Absolutely. And there were many reviews that discuss the choice. What are we going to choose? Will we choose socialism or will we choose barbarism? And I absolutely agree with that. I think that it's ultimately the cautionary tale, because we are, like many countries right now, right on the cusp, and we need to make that decision.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the movie poses that question in this sort of scary but evocative way.
And the way that television and film works now, it's not over till it's over. because Joker ends the way that it ends, does not mean that's the end.
No.
So the hope for revolt and revolution and the destruction of capitalism is still possible in the DC comic world. We shall see. Victoria Saucedo, thank you for joining me this morning to talk about Joker.
Thanks for having me over here.
And this is the Old Mole Variety Hour. Joker is playing out and about everywhere. Lots of opportunities to support smaller theaters in your efforts to see this film.
Well, thank you, Victoria and Denise, for that review of Joker. We'll link to other reviews on the webpage for the show. And that concludes today's Old Mole Variety Hour. Many thanks to Bill Resnick and Marty Hart Landsberg for their discussion of what the Green New Deal movement needs to learn from the movement that produced the original New Deal. Their discussion will continue on next week's Old Mole when they take up the lessons of the first Roosevelt New Deal for today's Green New Deal. Thanks also to Joe Clement for bringing us the Leon Russellson song, Who Reaps the Profits, Who Pays the Price? And again to our movie moles Denise Morris and Victoria Saucedo for their take on Joker. I'm Clayton Morgridge. Our engineer is Patricia Kullberg. Remember that you can hear this show again or any part of it and recommend it to your friends by finding us online at kboo.fm/oldmole or by subscribing to our podcast. Join us again next week for more news, views, reviews, and interviews from the Moles Underground Perspective.